Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
And if we don't give them a channel to change the world in which they live here and now, you will have deviances and you will have them falling into the hands of people who are unscrupulous and will take advantage of their youth, and they can do terrible things.
That's the voice of Dr. Maria Paez, Venezuelan sociologist. On this week's show, we speak to Maria Paez about her newest book, Liberty or Death, The Life and Campaigns of Richard L. Vowell, British Legionnaire and Commander, Hero and Patriot of the Americas. Maria speaks about her book and brings it to a contemporary context of what we can do to completely transform our society. So stay tuned.
You are listening to Latin Waves. We are speaking with Dr. Maria Paez Victor on her book, Liberty or Death, The Life and Campaigns of Richard L. Vowell. Now, when you describe this amazing journey of this young man who went against his class, went against his own so-called positioning in life, and fought alongside Simon Bolivar, we're painting an image of society that doesn't always determine who we are or how we act. And so this idea of empire, you know, this idea of him going there to fight the Spanish Empire, I wonder if you could maybe talk a little bit about what it means today to be in the struggle against a colonial process of global capitalism that is proposed as democratic, is proposed as being a way forward rather than another form of imperialism conquest.
The example that he sets is absolutely seminal right now, because most of us live like the goldfish in the bowl, in which we don't see the actual bowl. We think that this is the world. Remember when they said that history had finished. And so people thought, you know, there is no alternative. This is it. This is the world. This is the way things are, you know. The market, capitalism, the banks, you know, that's the way it is, and nothing can be done about it. Well, that is the defeatism, and this is exactly what they want. And to counter that, what we need to do is to have awareness of our circumstances. The great Spanish philosopher Ortega y Gasset, I am I and my circumstances. I don't entirely agree with him, because those circumstances are not exactly fixed. Yes, they are given, but you have to have awareness of those circumstances, because most of the circumstances in which we live were made by people. We make this social world in which we live in. That, yes, we can change our circumstances. Now, maybe you won't be able to do it single-handed. In the United States, they have this myth, you know, of the Lone Ranger, of the Superman, of the great person doing this or the other. No, Simón Bolívar did not free Latin America single-handedly. He was the spearhead, yes, but behind him was a whole people, and he was able to express the desires of a whole people. And he couldn't have done anything without that cohesion. So right now, we have to awaken our world. We have to awaken ourselves and those around us as to what are the chains that bind us now? And what are the things worth fighting for? And yes, you know, for the British Legion and for those that fought there, you know, and to die for. Not that we want people to die. We want people to live. But what we want people to do is for them to be aware of these circumstances and how the circumstances are trying to direct you to on a certain way. And we have to say, is that the way we want? Is this the society that we want? Is this what, you know, our forefathers had fought for? If this is what our foremothers suffered for, what is it that we want for our children? And we, each of us, have to choose where we want to act in the best way that we can. For some people, it'll be education. Others will be politics. Others will be the media. But the point is that those circumstances are made by human beings and they can be changed by human beings. Right now, there are people that criticize, and this is a tricky thing that I'm going to say. There are fights in the Middle East and in other places of the world, and sometimes you have people who volunteer to go to those fights, people who volunteer for the Islamic sort of fights that are going on in the Middle East, and indeed, apparently, there are volunteers also in Ukraine. Now, the point is that youth always seeks something exciting. So this is something that young people do. So we have to ask ourselves, what are we teaching young people? Why do they feel they have to go somewhere else to do their fighting? Why can't the fight be here? Not fight, but struggle mainly is what I want to say. These are people who want a different world. And if we don't give them a channel to change the world in which they live here and now, you will have deviances and you will have them falling into the hands of people who are unscrupulous and will take advantage of their youth, and they can do terrible things. We must allow for this change. We mustn't allow governments, and it's very scary right now, because the Western democracies are the ones that are demonstrating all the terrible thing that Orwell had talked about. When Orwell wrote Animal Farm, he had in his mind the Soviet Empire, the Soviet Union. He thought that he was writing a satire about the Soviets. Now, when we read Orwell now, and I urge everyone to read Animal Farm, you realize, well, that's long gone. That's not what's happening. What's happening is Animal Farm is happening here in the West, where we have a media that lies. Not that it gets it wrong, not that it's putting a spin, but the overt lie. As Orwell said, in a time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. And the media is complicit in these lies. I know personally of the lies. Maybe I don't know the lies that are going on about the Middle East and Russia and all that, because I don't know that much about that part of the world, but I certainly know the lies that are being told and have been told about Latin America, about President Chavez, about President Maduro, about President Evo Morales and Correa, and what is happening in the progressive countries in Latin America, even in Argentina and Brazil. And so we look at a media which is owned by great magnets, by great corporations that have cornered the media. The free press is sort of not there, and is telling lies about the political situations that are out there. So we have to be even more critical, even more aware. We have to find the truth. And the only way to find the truth is to read many things, to look for the many sources, to not just rely on the New York Times or the Washington Post. We have to go out there and try at this. There's almost too much information in the internet. One has to be careful, but one has to look for it and not stop seeking that awareness, because unless we know what our chains are, we will never be free of them. So I really think that the example of this young man who in 1817 left everything because he believed in liberty. And we have to believe in liberty, but we also have to believe in solidarity, which is exactly what he did. He gave up his life in solidarity for those he thought were in chains.
When I think about the significant ways in which Latin America has been transforming in the past two decades, and particularly since the election of President Chavez, we've seen significant changes, not just in the poverty reduction, but we've also seen incredible interlinking connections to how we reimagine, links of solidarity that are among equals, not among relationships of power. power domination, if you want to describe it in such terms. Can you talk a little bit about the significance of having our own ways of connecting locally and regionally to create a world where not only this idea of empire becomes something of the past and something that maybe we can finally surpass as a society, as peoples?
You know, connecting is something that doesn't just come, you know, because you want it. This is something that you actively have to work at. And one of the very interesting things about the situation in Venezuela is the following. It of course, it has problems, the normal problems under development, which the revolution is trying to solve. But one of the main things about the revolution is disconnecting, because we in Venezuela, in particular, had been atomized. There was no solidarity anywhere. Even the trade unions were a total mess. And one of the things of the revolution has been that we are together in this. That we are a new man or woman, like Che Guevara had said. That the revolution is here to help each other. Now, what did the government do? One of the things that the government did was say, well, we can't do everything by ourselves. We need the people. So the PSUV, that's the party of the government, opened its arms to the social movements. So when they have meetings, they also include the social movements to come, the social movements of campesinos, of workers, or whatever. They are also part of it. The other thing which they did was, well, we can't change a country all by ourselves. They have to do this themselves. And so they connected people with the communal councils. The communal councils have been a phenomenon. I'm just so amazed that the world, the rest of the world, I should say, because many in Latin America know about this, haven't realized what the communal councils, how it has transformed the statehood of Venezuela. Everybody in the region where they live are part of a communal council. You don't have to be elected to it or anything. You just arrive there. The communal councils then are organized into communes, because they send their representatives to communes. The communal councils are linked to the municipal councils. The municipalities can't do anything without the input and the acceptance of the communes. The commune representatives go all the way to the cabinet. So the cabinet meets with the communes. Can you imagine the cabinet of Harper meeting with social movements and with town hall groups all over the country? I mean, it just doesn't happen here. Well, this is what's happening in Venezuela. And this has helped people, not only politically, which, of course, it's very important politically, because then they have a say how the monies are spent, you know, where the houses are going to go, where the streets are going to be fixed, all of these kind of things. But what it has done, it has connected people to each other, people who had never spoken to each other, people who had never known each other. So you could be in a commune and you could be a teacher, and right next to you there is a fisherman. And right next to you is the person who sells stuff, you know, on the street. And next to you could be, you know, a lawyer or a doctor. And so it has been a real eye-opener. And what I have noticed in Venezuela is that the people like it, that when they talk about it, there's a happiness about it. And indeed, this is why I think Venezuela has ranked amongst the highest countries that on the happiness index is Venezuela. Not because all their problems have been solved, because, you know, this is what the critics always like to say. Oh, well, there's traffic, and oh, there's not enough, you know, bubble gum, and or things like this being sold or whatever. But the fact that people feel that they have a say in their government, that they are happy with the democracy, and that they see a future for themselves. They are optimistic, in other words. Now, this does not happen unless you are connected with your fellow beings in where you live. Now, consider this to what has happened in the United States, in Missouri, quite lately. I don't know what was more shocking, the death of that young man in Missouri, or the appalling, appalling statements of the authorities. And you see that that is a state and a city that is completely disconnected to its humanity, to itself, to its fellow people. The Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela has helped people connect to those who are different from them. In a country where homosexuality is just like horror, okay? People to be derided, something to be hidden, something to be, you know, and dangerous. The Bolivarian Revolution say everyone has human rights and we must respect their human rights. This is amazing in a country where, you know, you would imagine people would be quite macho the guys, you know, and Chavez, who was himself a very macho person and a very military person, was one of the ones who said, no, human rights are human rights and they apply to everyone. Again, feminism. In a country where, oh well, he beat up his wife, was just something that they put under the rug. You know, the police and the, you know, the authorities, you know, weren't taking that seriously. President Chavez, you know, announces, "I am a feminist. You know, I was brought up by my mother, my grandmother. I have daughters and granddaughters, and the rights of women are really important." And then all of a sudden, all kinds of monies and organizations were opened up for the help and welfare of women. This is called leadership. This is called taking people and telling them we are responsible for each other, even when we are different from each other, and we will respect each other's human rights. And I haven't even talked about indigenous people. So the indigenous people in Venezuela have always lived, you know, apart. They haven't really been too visible, especially in the cities where most people live. And of course, this revolution, one of the first things it did was put all the indigenous rights right in the Constitution. The Constitution itself translated into all 32 indigenous languages and all sorts of things that are beneficial for indigenous peoples occurred, plus the acceptance and respect of their leaders, which is really absolutely important, their leaders and their territories. So when you talk about connectedness, connectedness is just something that governments have to work at, that organizations, social organizations have to work at. This is the stuff that really binds us together and makes us be able to transform our society into something that we really truly want and need and is beneficial for all who live in that society, no matter how diverse it may be.
I was thinking about the significance that has having a president in a country who declares his alliance with the indigenous people, with women, with the poor. And, you know, because in many ways we are always looking at the way original peoples here in North America, whether it's the States or in Canada, are constantly being racialized, you know, in profile and persecuted. But and their responsibility always goes to the police. We're saying the police are racist. But really, you know, when we think about the role that the police has, is one of racialized order, right? Of maintaining a colonial order. So unless we understand what that inherent assumption we make, you know, of one nation being able to be the empire of the day, whether it's the United States or whether, you know, I mean, in the case of the story you're telling with Richard Bauer, we were talking about the Spanish Empire, you know, and it was just assumed that it was their right to colonize, to exploit, to plunder the lands of Latin America. And so it took a shift in how we understood that relationship. It took a shift in how this young man who was British understood his role in society, his alliance. Who is he allied with, right? The people or this particular power? So I wonder if we could just maybe briefly talk about the kinds of organizations that we, as we reimagine the world in new ways, have created as a result of the Bolivarian Revolution in Latin America, the Mercosur, for instance, the Telesur, the new ideas about how, what the role of media is, what the role of commerce, what the role of having a community that's engaged in redefining, you know, the relationship between us as the citizens and the governments that we elect.
Well, that's a tall order, but one of the consequences of the Bolivarian Revolution was the idea of Bolivar. Bolivar's idea was that Latin America had to be united, because if they did not unite, and he could see it clearly, they would become pawns of the great powers. He was particularly worried about the United States because he realized what was happening there, and of course Europe too. So Bolivar's words right now, his ideology has been just gone to the forefront because, you know, it is so important today. And this is what President Chavez struggled for and obtained when he went around to all his counterparts in Latin America and said, we've got to unite. And therefore, we had UNASUR, CELAC, MERCOSUR, which was there before, but it was changed in its focus, PetroSUR, PetroCaribe. When President Chavez says, we are going to provide oil to the small islands in the Caribbean at a special price, under special conditions, that was revolutionary because it was a connectedness. It was, we are with you. You won't have to pay these terrible international prices. We're going to give you a special price, and you will pay us back, but you're not going anywhere. So it can take many years. You know, the countries are immortal, aren't they? And so the countries pay back with low interest and have many, many years to pay. This is really a huge loan. When President Chavez says, we have to create PetroSUR. So he went around, he said to the organization of the other countries, let's have an organization of all our own national oil companies together, and that's PetroSUR. Then UNASUR was for the defense. They said, we will defend Latin America, not the United States. And MERCOSUR said, okay, we're going to trade with each other, but we're going to trade on a basis of equality, of respect. We're not going to try and pull the wool over each other's eyes. We're going to try and do it as a just sort of commercialization, which is, you know, markets. We're always going to have markets. Markets have existed since human societies have existed. So the market isn't the problem. It's how we organize that market. Is it this capitalist market where, you know, all we want is profit and you know, I will try to get as much out of you as I possibly can, or a market that is done like the Mercosur is doing, trying to respect each other's differences and each other's strengths, which takes a lot of time, but still it's worth doing. So this is the type of organization that can help us. Organizations that are not top-down, organizations that are not there to colonize us, to take advantage of the other's weaknesses, organizations that have mutuality, and that is really important. This is something that we have forgotten, and at least I think in the North. So, you know, it's not right that, for example, foreign aid is given to countries, which Canada does, and so it says, okay, here's foreign aid, we give you this money so you can buy our tractors, or I give you this money so you can buy our wheat, or I give you this, or in other words, the money comes back to us. This isn't aid, of course. Imagine Canada's foreign affairs ministry is also linked with the trade ministry. You know, they just can't seem to separate the two. So I think in this terrible world which we're in right now, where there are conflicts everywhere, the Latin American example is a light shining in the darkness. You have the countries that have come together in organizations such as UNASUR, CELAC, MERCOSUR, PETROSUR, TELESUR, Radio del Sur. They have come together with differences. They aren't all on the same, but it doesn't matter because they respect each other's votes, really, their elections. And they are working together to help each other solve their mutual collective problems. Because the problems that Venezuela has are identical to the problems that Peru has, or Brazil has, or Nicaragua has. These are the underlying great problems of underdevelopment, which come from colonization, I may say, because the exploitation. I hope you don't think I'm deviating from the topic, but I have just come back from 10 days in Iceland. And when I was there in this tiny, lovely, beautiful, fascinating country, I went to their museums in Reykjavik, and I was struck. It is the first time that I walk into a European museum, a museum of a European country, and all the artifacts and all the displays were about their own country. There was no loot from the oppression or the colonization or the stealing from other countries. It was such a pleasure. And it brought back to me that fact. When I have been, and I have been, in the great museums of Europe, which are jewels, don't think that I'm being anti-intellectual here and trashing the museums of the world. I'm just examining. I'm just being critical. I'm being aware that most of these beautiful, grand, marvelous institutions are full of the loot of the colonization and the oppression of these powerful European countries to other countries. Even here in Canada, I go to the ROM, and what do I see? I see, the ROM is the Royal Ontario Museum of Ontario, I see a splendid exhibition of Chinese art. Well, how did they get this? The missionaries went to China and just brought all this loot back. And there's another wonderful, marvelous exhibition of Egyptian art. And again, where did this come from? They walked into Egypt and they brought it back. Now, it's done, and it's there, and I don't want to appear to be trashing the Royal Ontario Museum or the Louvre or the Prado or the these great museums of the world, but I am looking at how they got to be. And when I contrast that to little Iceland, whose museum is dedicated to itself, I say, you see, we don't have to live like that. We don't have to live exploiting. We don't have to live looting. These great powers, if they put a quarter of their efforts towards the benefit of their own country and the benefit of other peoples, we would solve the poverty in the world and all that the ramifications that come from poverty.
Mm. The idea that we as people can create a society where we're not objects of capital, where we're not, you know, objects of empire, but rather as, you know, as equals, as people who see the inherent and sacred beauty in each other's life, it's already here. You know, that idea, that world is already being born, is already being created in multiple of places where you see, whether it's in communal councils, whether it is in cooperatives, whether it is in ways that people come together to be in solidarity with others. I think those ideas are already, you know, birthing and generating fruit, you know, and we see that. So thank you so much for bringing us, you know, this rich history. We have come to the end of our program. Latin Ways is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwaysmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.